And now on to a new topic, because this year, actually, my 13-year-old daughter had to build a 3D model of the DNA molecule out of pipe cleaners and pasta for a class assignment, and it was more than a hint that people around the world would be refocusing their attention on a famous discovery made public 50 years ago last week. And that was on April 25, 1953, when James Watson and Francis Crick published a small research paper in the journal Nature. The paper described the shape of the DNA molecule as a double-winding staircase, a double helix. And the knowledge of that structure has made possible a half-century's worth of advances in the field of molecular biology, from the sequencing of the human genome to the application of genetics to fields as far-flung as forensics, agriculture, and criminal justice. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Watson about that pivotal discovery 50 years ago. He is with us today. He is author of DNA, The Secret of Life, published this year by Knopf. He's a 1962 Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine. He's president of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. And he's with us today in our Science Friday studios. Welcome back to the program, Dr.
Thank
Watson.
Thank you very much.
You were listening to this with me. It was fascinating to hear about the stem cell research.
Oh, very much so.
Could you have ever foreseen anything like this 50 years ago?
No, absolutely not.
What did you expect when you made the discovery? Go tell us, you know, what was in your mind. It opens the avenue to what now?
Well, to finding the genetic code and how genes function in cells. We knew there was a relationship between genes and protein, sort of. One gene specified a protein, and we wanted to know how the sequence of bases along the DNA molecule specified the order of amino acids along the polypeptide chains of proteins.
Mm-hmm. And what was the atmosphere like? I know there was a race going on. Was there not, to be the first to? And well, Linus Pauling was in this race with you also, to be the first to decipher the structure.
Well, I may have been the only person to think of a race. Linus Pauling generally didn't think about other people, so he certainly wasn't racing us. I mean, he was very well known. We were. No one knew of our existence outside of Cambridge, England.
You were only 25.
Yes.
25. That's up there with Einstein in relativity when he was 26.
Well, I was sort of told that before. I assumed I might be too old to do something unusual.
And you got into the field, so to speak, when you were just 17, right?
That's when I read the book What Is Life by Erwin Schrödinger, and he said that the genetic information was stable, and hence it had to be on a molecule. And he didn't know which molecule it was, but really the time he wrote the book, there was work at the Rockefeller Institute here in New York City, which said DNA molecules carried hereditary information. And that's what set me off mm-hmm. on my search to find what was the three-dimensional structure of DNA.
So you knew what you knew exactly what you wanted to find.
Yeah, it seemed to me to Francis Crick that this was the most important problem in biology at that time.
Now, Crick is a little older than you, and was he sort of your mentor at that point, being 25 or younger than that?
Well, he certainly knew a lot more than I did about the techniques which you use to establish three-dimensional structures.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about Rosalind Franklin. How much did you rely on her X-ray photographs taken by that?
Oh, they were a big incentive when I saw this photograph with a big cross on it. It said it was a helix. So it's a complicated story. We could have, Linus Pauling, who didn't have access to the work of King's, he should have solved it without the King's data, because there was enough other data mm-hmm. in the literature, which if you just took a couple steps forward, you could do. So it was really a problem which was sort of overdetermined. In reality, we knew the people at King's, and when we saw the double helix, which was so much simpler than anyone had anticipated, It was pretty awkward. It was wonderful. And how to acknowledge the fact that we had seen data from King's.
All right, we're going to take Dr. Watson. We have to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with James Watson and take your phone calls talking about the 50th anniversary of that Nature paper. So don't go away. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with James Watson, author of DNA, The Secret of Life, published by Knopf. I want to go to the phone now because there's a seventh grade class in Wilson Middle School in Appleton, Wisconsin, that Karen Sinclair is on the phone. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Is your class studying DNA, this unit?
We have finished studying DNA, and we are diving into genetics at this point. We've talked about Drs. Watson and Crick at length, and the kids have come up with a few questions that they'd like to ask. I have Dustin Kinky here. I have Georgia Adkins, Garrett Hing, Kyle Vandenhoevel, Milo Fisher, and Anthony Kasai. I don't know how many questions you can take today.
Let's go. We'll go for one at a time and see what happens.
All right. Here's DJ. Thank you.
Hello. What inspired you to start looking for DNA?
I thought it was going to be the secret of life. That is, it carried the hereditary information. And we wanted to know, how could a molecule carry hereditary information?
Mm-hmm. Next question, someone?
Hi, I'm Georgia Adkins. I was wondering how you discovered DNA.
Well, we didn't discover DNA. We worked out its three-dimensional shape. It was discovered almost 100 years before in Switzerland.
Did you figure it had to be symmetrical some way because of it had to reproduce itself or possible clue that way?
We thought it was, if it wasn't symmetrical, we wouldn't be able to guess the structure, so right. We hoped it would be symmetrical.
All right, let's go back to the class. Yeah, another question from the class?
This is Garrett Hing, and I was wondering, what was your first discovery?
Well, that was my first real discovery in my life. I'd done some experimental work, but it wasn't very exciting. So this was my first big thing.
Garrett, he wasn't much older than you are. He was 25 when they made that discovery. So you see, you don't have to be an old white-haired guy to do that. One more question we'll take. Anybody else?
Yeah, this is Anthony.
Hi, Anthony.
How old are you?
Now I'm 75.
75?
Do you want to be a scientist, Anthony?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling. Thanks for class. Thank Karen Sinclair for us.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. What was the reception of the paper in Nature? Was it a big splash?
No. There was a little article in the New York Times. Time magazine considered covering it and sent a photographer to photograph us. But they got some photographs of us, but never used them and never wrote a story.
Is that right?
And over the next 7 years, the double helix was not much discussed.
Why was that?
Most people thought it was a speculative thing, not the structure, but whether the structure did what we thought it would, which was for the two chains to come apart and each of the single chains serve as a template performing the second chain.
What would you say that you are, in all the things that have, all the products and spin-offs and whatever that have, all the research that's come over the year, what are you most proud of for the use that the DNA has been put to?
Well, it's leading us to understand cancer. Mm-hmm. That's been my own personal objective from almost 40 years now. Mm-hmm. And without being able to study the disease at the DNA level, we wouldn't know what's wrong. Now we realize cancer is due to a series of mistakes in the copying of DNA, so the genes don't function normally.
Mm-hmm. I was at the 50th anniversary party that was in New York a couple months ago. I listened to you speak very well at the podium. And I heard you say that you were also proud of the fact that DNA now is used to free prisoners who are wrongly behind bars?
Well, that's the most obvious public benefit. It's revolutionizing criminal justice. So police lineups aren't very accurate when you come and say, oh, I saw that person. DNA, if you can get it from the scene of a crime, it's absolutely accurate.
Would it have been, and was it in anybody's mind, to patent the discovery back then? And today, could you get away with not patenting something?
Well, when we had it, we didn't know how to do anything useful with it. So to get a patent, it has to be useful. One of the inventors of the nuclear reactor, Leo Szilard, who had a patent with Einstein, he was there when I gave my first public talk, and he raised the question, shouldn't I patent it? And almost instantly we said no. And, of course, I think at that time, if I'd tried to patent it, I would have been thought of as a rather evil person.
Not today, though.
Not today.
Not today. It's come a long way. Let's go to the phones. Tom in Hudson, Ohio. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I would like the doctor to comment on the recent public broadcasting system airing of a documentary that says he and his team didn't know what they were doing until one of his colleagues stole the work of Rosie Franklin, which proved the double helix.
No, it's a complicated story whether we should have used data. I wrote a book about this, The Double Helix, but I haven't seen the documentary. I was in Europe at the time it came out, so I can't comment really on it specifically.
But this has been talked about for years, accusations against you.
Yeah, I was originally going to call my book, which is now called The Double Helix, Honest Jim, because someone from King's saw me and on a mountain walk and called me Honest Jim. And that raised the question, did Francis Crick and I inappropriately use the data? I think most people say no. Rosalind Franklin didn't get the structure because she had the data, which we saw approximately a year, and it was shown to me by one of her colleagues at King's, so we didn't go into the desk. And it was sort of an argument I had with her. I said, it's a helix, and she said, it's not a helix. And Morris Wilkins, who'd argued with her.
It's her boss, right?
Well, no, he wasn't her boss. That was sort of the trouble. He was fed up with her and took me in the room and said, look, it's a helix. She was an intelligent woman, but she didn't want it to be a helix, and she didn't want to build models. She wanted to essentially arrive at its answer through mathematics. And we thought Linus Pauling had made a big advance in the structure of proteins through building models, and he got it right. And so maybe we would get it right by building models.
Right, Tom? Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. This book, DNA, The Secret of Life, your book, I'll tell you, I'm shocked about how easy it is to read it. I read a lot of science books, and I never expected a book. And this is basically a history of all the history of genetics. And it's so easy to read. I'm surprised, pleasantly surprised. Did you set out to purposely make it very easy, readable?
Yes, and I have a very talented co-author, Andrew Berry, who's a super writer. And so we ended up with sentences which in many cases would be twice as long as I would write. I always tried to write things very terse, but that's not very good for outsiders. I think the reason why we think it's a good book is we have a lot of good stories to tell. It's not just facts. It's sort of stories, you know, how DNA fingerprints came about or, how we have genetically modified plants and should we worry about them and how do we handle genetic diseases and is it nature or nurture? So even 10 years ago, I think it would have been hard to write a book for the general public, but suddenly with the completion of the Book of Life, the human genome sequence, it's a great story.
Do you think that most people are very science illiterate, and this is your way of reaching people who might have trouble with something a little more complicated?
Actually, we found that our scientific friends enjoy it, too.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of these personal stories people don't know, and I've lived through it. Andrew Berry wasn't born when the story started, but I've been sort of in the center of it for 50 years. So it was a fun book to write. Yeah. I wrote a book 15 years after. No, it was a it took 10 years after finding the double helix before we knew enough to have a story. And then I wrote a book called The Molecular Biology of the Gene. And mm-hmm. It was fun writing because it was a good story.
This is a great story. You say some very interesting and, I have to say, controversial things in your book, like, and we talked about this a little bit before, you say, I think everyone should give a DNA sample. And you've had trouble understanding the furor that has created.
Yes, people, think we should have a right to be anonymous. But if a crime has been committed, I think it's... the right to stay silent sort of disappears because of the moral outrage we feel. A murder has been committed, and you want to find out who committed the murderer.
Mm-hmm. And so you can't see the problems about people thinking their privacy. If they, even innocent people would think that now there's a big master book of everybody's DNA.
But, I think there are a lot of people who have difficulty establishing their identity. Mm-hmm. They come from abroad, and who are they? And, if they could come in and say, look, this is my, this is what I looked like when I was born, and this is me. So in many cases, you think, well, this is going to take away your civil liberties, but I think it might give you them under circumstances when, and certainly if you haven't committed a crime or you're not the father of a child, mm-hmm. you can prove the facts.
Mm-hmm. You also have I'll put it this way, very short temper for people who do not get it about genetically modified foods, genetically modified plants. You can't really.
I guess I've grown up with this. I was on the first really governmental committee anywhere to investigate whether agricultural chemicals were safe. Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring.
Right.
And the real conclusion was they kill insects with poisons. And sometimes they're poisonous for us. And so when it came along that you could build plants which had within them the poisons that would kill the insects, so the farmer didn't have to apply the poisons.
Like BT corn, things like
that. Yeah. I thought, how wonderful for farm laborers. They're not going to get sick. And then I was once sprayed. I was chairman of President Kennedy's Committee on the Cotton Insects. So we were down in Texas and driving through cotton area. The plane came over. We were sprayed. And I think we weren't the only person who's ever been sprayed. Mm-hmm. So people think, that it's a perfect world now, but it's not. We deal with poison, so to me the plants were a safer way. That's why I sort of have a short fuse on that, because the biggest cause of poisoning probably in the United States is accidental poisoning is farm chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Talking with James Watson on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Myra Flato, have you been surprised yourself at how quickly or speed in recent years things have snowballed in genetics research? Or did
it's
you
sort of going in a, exponential fast, going faster and faster because... And the Human Genome Project was a way of speeding it up, of really finding out what are the changes in DNA which lead to specific genetic diseases. So I've been very, very pleased.
Yeah. Are you surprised how quickly the Genome Project was finished?
No.
No.
My role in it was, at the very beginning, to try and get the program run by highly intelligent, highly motivated people. And... that's the only credit I should get. The people who did it were bright.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk to James Watson. How is Francis Crick? He's ill, is he not?
Well, he's 12 years older than I, so mm-hmm. he's approaching being 87.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a heart bypass, and that's a little... But his brain is still very good. And so life isn't as perfect for him now. He doesn't want to travel, but we saw him sort of on videotape, and he's so forceful. You know, when Francis is in the room, I don't have to say anything.
Some people would say that's hard to imagine. You're not saying anything.
No. No, it's really that Francis, you know, doesn't like to appear in public, yeah. and someone has to. So,
do you feel like you've mellowed yourself over the years?
Fortunately, not. Because, you know, I want to get things done, and if people seem to be holding up progress, not move forward, I get angry.
Uh-huh. You've written that the next holy grail of genetics is the complete human transcriptome. What is that?
Well, we want to know where every gene is expressed, say, in the human body, in what tissues, and at what time during a human existence. So that's a big problem. The other big problem is, you know, we all don't look alike. In fact, you can almost tell, you know, everyone's different. So we have a lot of differences between us that give us, some people are more prone to arthritis, others to cancer, psoriasis down the line. We want to really understand this variability and help people who have predispositions which set back their lives.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. 1-800-989-8255. Seth in Denver. Hi, Seth.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. And Dr. Watson, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you and ask a question. First of all, one of my very favorite books about molecular biology, which I recommend to everybody, is Horace Freeland Judson's The Eighth Day of Creation. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
I just thought it was wonderful as he traces the revolution in molecular biology through various Nobel laureates. My question for you is that sometimes, as a layperson, I've been enormously impressed by the intellectual power that went into experiments and where results were able to be deduced, such as Jacob and Monod's work on the lac operon model. And sometimes I've been very surprised with the results, as simple as they are, such as Chek's work, which refuted central dogma.
You know, we can't get into dogma on this show, you know.
Jargon
and dogma are banished.
So no one knows
what you're talking
okay,
about.
Well, Tom Chek.
You have a question quickly because we're going up on a break. If you have
okay,
a question.
My question is, what is your favorite experiment? What is the most surprising result? And, you know, where do you see the greatest intellectual creative contribution?
All right, we're gonna let Dr. Watson think about that a little bit because we have to take our break and come back and let him answer that question after the short break. So stay with us. We'll be right back with James Watson, author of the book DNA, The Secret of Life. Just out, a very interesting read. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. On Monday's Talk of the Nation, join Neil Conan and his guests for a look at the Democratic presidential hopefuls, how public opinion will shape their campaigns. We're talking this hour with Dr. James Watson, author of DNA, The Secret of Life, out this year from Knopf, 1962 Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine, president of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, in New York. Our number 1-800-989-8255. I was going to let you, Dr. Watson, think about that answer. Where is the future? Where is the cutting edge of genetics?
Well, there are many cutting edges.
I'm sure there are.
My own one is I just want cancer stopped. I think over the next decade we could do it.
But we've been saying this for 4 decades,
I know,
haven't we?
And,
it's always the next decade that we're
no,
going to do
this. I can
tell
point.
Me how. Tell me how
no,
it's
no,
going to
no,
happen.
Let me just go back. In 1974, mm-hmm. soon after the war on cancer, and they were right. talking about a 10-year. Right. I got myself very unpopular and said we have at least a 30-year war ahead. It was going to be very complex. During this now 40 years, we've discovered an enormous amount. And I believed that the ideas of Judah Folkman, that if you could shut off the blood supply to tumors, this might be a general way of stopping all cancer. And
so far it hasn't panned out yet.
No, in fact, it has in a very small way. So, in fact, when I leave these studios, I'm going to be going and talking to people about trying to find money to increase the scope of the test. So that's my personal objective right. over the next. I want to sort of not give another public lecture in my life.
But do you need to be a public advocate, if not a lecturer? Do you need, and do scientists in general now?
Yes, I've been a public advocate for most of 50 years. So I think if we're not, we're irresponsible to our fellow people.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the war on terrorism is an opportunity for scientists to get money for research that
well,
they didn't have before?
We want to know more about infectious diseases. Mm-hmm. We want to have more antiviral agents through the human genome studies. We now know the basic components of bacteria, so we're much better able to. Mm-hmm. Do it, but it's a big problem.
Was the Human Genome Project the easy stuff? Deciphering the genome, the easy stuff, and now
yes.
the hard work is really ahead of us.
Yes, I mean that was we went to Congress and said, "Give us $3 billion in 15 years," and that was what it was. So it was like engineering. It's when people went to President Kennedy and said, we can get to a man on the moon. They could write down on paper how to do it. So we could write down on paper. Now, it turned out, fortunately, many procedures got greatly improved and the cost went down and we could do it faster and you could replace people by machines. And it just became so much more accurate. Mm. But when we went there, I didn't feel I was selling a project which wouldn't succeed. I thought there'd be a lot more people involved, as it was. You go into a lab and you just see machines.
If you were starting over, if you were 17 again now, which path would you
pick? Oh, I'd go into biology, and I'd try and find the relations between genes and behavior.
And we just finished talking about that last hour. And that is a fascinating and very difficult area, is it not?
Well, right now with the Human Genome Project, our personalities have to, in some sense, be partially controlled by our genes. That's shown by identical twin studies. And so we're going to find the molecular differences which give rise to different personalities. Of course, that's not going to tell us how the brain works or, really solve the deeper problems. But on the other hand, it just may seem one neurotransmitter is present in a larger mouth, and that's why the guy's a loud mouth. He's got too much of something.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if I can get a phone call or two in before we have to leave. Candace in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Candace. Candace, are you there? Line 7? Candace? No, I guess Candace is gone. 1-800, let's see if I can go one more on the phone line here. Let's go to, is it Denny in Carson City, Nevada?
Yes, sir.
Hi, quickly.
Hi, my name is Denny French, and I'd just like to thank you all for the great program. I'd like to thank Mr. Watson for being on. His contributions are amazing. I would like to say that I do feel that that's sort of overshadowed by my feelings that Ms. Franklin's involvement and her contributions have been really watered down and that she's not getting near the credit she should. The double helix type situation probably would have taken a lot longer if perhaps, I don't know how much longer, had she not done the diligence work as far as her x-ray photos. And I feel that there was a bit of a sexist type situation scenario at the time, and I wonder if Mr. Watson might want to respond to his sense of the time and the relationship to women in science and how that is now as opposed to then.
Mm-hmm. Has the women in science attitude changed?
Oh, greatly. But I don't think Rosalind's problems came from being a woman. She was very difficult to get along with, and rather pig-headed. She didn't listen to other people. Now, those qualities are possessed by many, many men, maybe most men. Mm-hmm. So I think...
Did that have anything to do with her not getting the credit or the attention? Well, her attitude?
The chief reason she didn't get credit was that she died. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much attention paid to me in the first 5 years after getting the structure. Afterwards, Rosalind and I knew each other. We had a common research objective at times. Francis Crick became very close to her. And we offered at the time to publish a joint paper. So I totally disagree with everything that's been said before. Mm-hmm. I think Wilkins was the one who really got shafted. I mean, in the sense that Rosalind essentially wanted to take away his problem. And if she'd worked with him, they would have got the answer, and Crick and Watson's names would not be now famous.
Mm-hmm. She died early, in early life.
Yes, tragically, she got ovarian cancer. But
I think it had anything to do with the fact she dealt with x-rays and was working with x-rays.
I doubt it, because x-rays don't really... They're soft. They don't probably didn't go to the ovary. But I can't say she was a bit... You know, in those days, people didn't take the precautions they now take. But my guess is she had this gene BRCA1, which predisposes you to ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm. So, in your laboratory in Gold Spring Harbor, what is the cutting edge there? What is the different areas of research that?
Well, we're interested in cancer, and right. We're interested in the brain. So, the brain is much more pure science. Mm-hmm. Cancer now, we're sort of moving. Our objective now is to cure it.
Is it in the engineering stage now, or still
almost?
Well, we haven't. Yeah, it's an engineering problem.
Yeah, otherwise I wouldn't say, you know, when you can write down on paper how you can do something, you know a lot. We don't mm-hmm. know anything about schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't say, you know, whether we have any chance over the next 100 years of doing anything about it at all. Mm-hmm. But about cancer, yes, I just think, get on with it and get the drugs.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get another phone call from Brett in Oakland. Hi, Brett.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question's on the completion of the Human Genome Project. And in articles I've read, supposedly there's large sections of the genome that have been labeled as junk DNA. So actually the entire genome hasn't been fully decoded, but only the portions that we think are important have.
No, those are the ones we think... It may be about 5% carrying meaningful information, and we couldn't know which were those 5% until we'd done the humans and done the mouse and comparing a series of species. So we can home in on this 5%. Now, that's the region that we're going to study and focus
the
on.
The junk DNA.
No, he's talking about
junk.
No, I don't want to, no one
wants... Why is it called junk DNA?
Because it doesn't do anything.
But okay. He's saying, gee, you should have studied that because maybe it does something. That's
I think we pretty well know most of it is truly junk. And common sense says study things which you know are
Why would
important.
We have junk? Why would we have something that's junk?
It was because of movable genetic elements. In a way, it was a price for speeding up the rate of evolution.
Mm-hmm. Talking with James Watson this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Is it surprising how little difference there is between our DNA and fruit flies and chimpanzees? And
when we started the project, we didn't have any feeling that virtually all mammals have identical genes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just when these genes are expressed and whether, one's highly active. So now, with roughly the same set of genes, we're trying to home in the most obviously interesting one are differences between chimpanzees and humans, because they're mm-hmm. our closest relation. And we just have a much more effective brain.
What's the most important thing for a young scientist to do to get on the right track of any?
Well, it's curiosity on an important problem. And in your education, you should really tell your students what are important problems. problems. And I had teachers who kept focusing on the gene, and then I started focusing on DNA because I thought DNA was going to be the gene.
Mm-hmm. But it's good to have teachers who were good mentors. Good people.
Yeah, I had super teachers. You know, if you say I had the perfect education for finding the structure of DNA, so
elaborate on that. What do you mean, perfect education for that?
Well, I was sort of part of two different traditions: the sort of structural biology tradition, which was very strong in England, and the sort of molecular genetics approach, which was then stronger in the United States. So I brought the sort of philosophy of the United States to Cambridge, England, and so I just said, study DNA.
Mm-hmm. Let's go see if we get another call in from Sonia in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Sonia.
Hello. Good afternoon, Dr. Watson.
If you turn off your radio, it'll help you a little bit talk on the phone here. Go ahead.
All right. I look forward to reading your book, DNA, The Secret of Life. I was wondering, in your long life of science, if you've discovered the meaning of life.
Ah, sweet mystery of life.
I don't think there is a meaning. Life can be a lot of fun and rewarding, but I don't think there's a meaning to the life of a dog any more than, I should make it clear, I'm totally not religious.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think we're here because of some higher purpose. We're just here.
Were you religious before you started studying the DNA?
No.
Afterward? Did you have a...
No, as I've said, I had the very good fortune of having a father who... thought religion was out of date,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't need it, and that our values really came out of human nature. They were the product of our evolution as a social species. That mm-hmm. is, the Ten Commandments sort of come out of human nature and not from a bolt mm-hmm. from the sky.
Sonia, does that answer your question? Because she's gone. You say you were fortunate not to have a father who was not religious. Do you think if he was, you might have gone in a different path?
Well, people, seem to be follow. Whether you can use the term imprinted or something, my parents were Democratic. I became a Democrat, which I consider very fortunate.
All right, we've run out of time, Dr. Watson. You'll have to come back some other time. James Watson is the author of DNA, The Secret of Life, published by Knopf. He's also the 1962 Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine and president of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in Cold Spring, New York. Book is a great read. I mean, if you know nothing about genetics, this is a great book to read. It's done in very simple terms and enjoyable reading. Thank you for joining us.
It's been fun talking to you and to the people who called in.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineer is Matt Galick here in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. If you want to know more about genetics and DNA, Dr. Watson's book, you missed any of the links we talk about, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, we'll have kids' curricula, children and students and teachers will make curricula out of Science Friday. It'll be there on our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also download and listen to Science Friday in your Audible player and get other kinds of links that Charles will have up on our website. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.